Good morning. The third member of our panel, Judge Ripple, is ill today and unable to sit with us during this session. He'll listen to the tapes of today's oral arguments and participate fully in the court's deliberations of the cases, so there won't be any interruption here. He will be hearing all of this on the tape. So we'll proceed with the first case of the morning, which is Colleen Kramer versus Bank of America. Mr. Hanifan.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Blake Hanifan on behalf of plaintiff appellant Colleen Kramer. The issue in this case, whether an ADA retaliation plaintiff is entitled to compensatory and punitive damages and thus a right to a jury trial under the ADA and the Civil Rights Acts of 1964 and 1991 has been addressed by several district courts. Three, in fact, the Ostrich Court in California, the Lovejoy Court in New York, and the Rhodes case in Maryland have decided that under the ADA, the retaliation statute 12203, a plaintiff is entitled to recover compensatory and punitive damages under section 1981A. In addition, the Eighth Circuit in the Foster case and Salatros and the Second Circuit in Moeller and Lovejoy have not addressed this issue specifically, but have confirmed decisions and verdicts in which compensatory or punitive damages were awarded by a jury for an ADA retaliation claim. The statute shows that when you start with section 12203, it refers directly to the remedies section of that statute. States that the remedies and procedures available under 12117 and others with respect to this subchapter 1 are available for the aggrieved persons. Therefore, under 12117 of the ADA, section A states the powers, remedies, and procedures set forth in sections 2000E4, 2000E5, and others in Title VII shall be the powers, remedies, and procedures this subchapter provides to any person alleging discrimination on the basis of disability.
So let me ask you this. Is that your basis for concluding that all Title VII remedies should be available to all ADA claims? Because that's what I understand your position is in the brief. I mean, that's what you're leading us toward.
Your Honor, there is case law that has addressed this, including the Baumgartner case in the Northern District and the Baird Rose case in the Fourth Circuit, which we cited, which have said that the intent of the law is for Title VII remedies to be available to mirror and parallel the ADA remedies.
But doesn't that ignore the text of 1981 AA2?
I don't think so, Your Honor.
Why not?
Well, because when you look at 1981A, the statement there is that in an action brought by a complaining party under the powers, remedies, and procedures set forth in the Civil Rights Act, the 2000E5, which is specifically incorporated in 12117, it provides that you have the right to compensatory and punitive damages. Essentially, an ADA plaintiff for retaliation under 12203 stands in the shoes of a Title I ADA plaintiff. And 1981A was meant to expand the remedies to include compensatory and punitive damages for Title VII and also for the ADA.
What if it doesn't list them? If it lists certain things for the ADA and doesn't list others, it seems that's the problem here, that there are specific extensions for the ADA, but it did not include compensatory and punitive damages for retaliation.
Well, first of all, Your Honor, the section that you refer to, the 12112, is part of Title I under the ADA, and its enforcement statute, its section comes from 12117 as well. And as 12203 says, the remedies allowed under 12117 are allowed for the retaliation plaintiff.
But don't you think Congress was certainly aware of the statutes and could have said very simply that all apply to this ADA, the ADA statutes, that the remedies all apply. But I'm following up on what Judge Mannion said. Everything was not specified, so doesn't that suggest that they didn't intend it to be covered?
No, I don't think that's true, Your Honor. I think by the incorporation of in 12.117, stating that all the remedies available under 2000E5, which is the Title VII enforcement, are all remedies that are allowed. There is not a dispute that a Title VII plaintiff is entitled to compensatory and punitive damages and thus a right to a jury trial. And as I said in the Baumgartner case, the Congress stated in their reports that the remedies would parallel and mirror Title VII, including any amendments to Title VII. 1981A obviously came after the ADA was done, as well as the 1964 Act, and is intended to expand it. This has also been addressed by the Ostrich Court, Lovejoy, and the Rhodes Court, which made this exact determination. They looked at the other cases that have held the one case in the District of Western District of Missouri, and found that by the inclusion of the 2000E5 language and the 12117 in 1981A, that provides the compensatory and punitive damages to 12203. And 1981A also states that 1981AC that if that if a party is seeking compensatory and punitive damages, like Ms. Kramer was in this case, that she's entitled to a jury. Therefore, Judge Zagel in the district court denial of her right to a jury trial was error, and it was not a harmless error, as shown by the evidence provided here. As I also mentioned, the Second Circuit in Mueller upheld a retaliation plaintiff's recovery of compensatory damages solely on retaliation. That court also stated, the Lovejoy Court, the district court, that the Second Circuit has routinely allowed retaliation claims to be tried to a jury. The Foster Court as well in the Eighth Circuit also had affirmed compensatory and punitive damages for an ADA defendant. In addition, I think they addressed, or surely could have addressed, this issue sua sponte, either in the district court or in the appellate courts, and they did not. In the Foster case, at the end they addressed, there was an issue regarding the instructions regarding punitive damages for the retaliation. And they stated, and I quote, "The instruction on Foster's claim of retaliation and punitive damages adequately stated the law. Finally, the defense damage instruction in 42 U.S.C. section 1981A.A.3 requested by Time Warner was not appropriate because Foster's claim was for retaliation under 42 U.S.C. section 12203A, not a claim for failure to provide an accommodation under section 12112B5. And that is the section that Your Honor pointed out is included in 1981A2. Mm-hmm. So I believe that, again, while I am not asserting that they specifically addressed this because it's unclear from the opinion, that they did review this and that the instruction in punitive damages were allowed.
At least it wasn't made an issue.
It was not made an issue.
Yeah. So they just either assumed it or nobody raised it, whatever. Of course, the jury... The right to a jury trial, statutory right, is certainly contingent on that issue. Now, I know you make a Seventh Amendment argument, but as far as obviously, if there's no right to compensatory or punitive damages under the retaliatory claim, then there wouldn't be a right to a jury trial under the statute.
Under the statute, yes, Your Honor. Furthermore, as I stated, this was not a harmless error when it was denied. The district court The standard had, the district court stated that no reasonable trier of fact could have found in Ms. Kramer's favor. We dispute that. The standard is set forth in Partee versus Birch, which is a Seventh Circuit case, as well as City of Morgantown in the U.S. Supreme Court, has held that a denial of a jury when it's proper is, of course, error. Then you have to look as if it's harmless error, and has said that it will only be harmless error in rare cases. The standard for this is whether, if it had been tried to a jury, that the district court would have granted a directed verdict, a Rule 50 motion for judgment as a matter of law. Under that standard of review, the district court is not allowed to make credibility determinations, nor is the district court allowed to consider evidence in favor of the moving party that our jury is not required to believe, and all reasonable inferences are supposed to be drawn in the non-moving party's favor.
Yeah, but you have a lot of problems in terms of the plaintiff's case, because she was criticized for her work performance, as I read the record, and the brief several times, and it was only late in the day that she even raised this whole disability and informed her employer about her condition. Isn't that right?
Well, I disagree that it was at the last moment, Your Honor. In June of 1999, she had written a letter requesting accommodations on behalf of an attorney had written a letter to BOA. She was, my time is up for rebuttal, but I'll answer this, Your Honor, because it's important. She wasn't fired until October 7th, 1999. The letter had been sent in June. September 28th of 1999, she informed Ms. Mixon and Ms. Moser, Ms. Moser being her direct supervisor, Ms. Mixon being Ms. Moser's supervisor, that she had filed a charge with the EEOC. She was fired 9 days later, and Ms. Moser testified at trial that but for this alleged lack of social ability, which was a criteria that was not listed in a BOA manual, it was applied solely to Ms. Kramer and came from an Ask Annie magazine article. And that Ms. Moser said that social ability is defined as the ability to draw support from and influence others. However, Ms. Mixon admitted that in order for Ms. Kramer to generate the high fees and do the work that she was doing, quote, she would have had to positively influence a lot of people in order to achieve a successful closing. That's at odds for Ms. Moser to say the definition is to draw influence and influence others, and Ms. Mixon says that clearly she was able to positively influence others. There was also a lot of testimony that Ms. Kramer had gotten along with Ms. Moser, Ms. Mixon, and other employees. This admission by Ms. Mixon is at odds with Ms. Moser's definition, and this is a credibility determination which a reasonable trier of fact could have disagreed with the district court. I will save the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Okay, thanks. Ms. Kirvin or Servin?
It's Servin, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court. Jennifer Servin on behalf of Bank of America Security. The outcome in this case would have been the same regardless of how the statutory jury issue had been decided, and that's because no reasonable jury would have found in her favor. It was harmless error. And I think in particular the timing is important of what was going on in terms of the counseling that was being given to plaintiff regarding her performance. Significantly, there was a change at the bank. There was a merger, and Ms. Kramer had a new supervisor, Ms. Moser. Starting in early 1999, there were a number of counseling sessions in which her performance issues were discussed, particularly teamwork, team issues. And in fact, at the end of May, she's actually replaced as team leader and given a very clear roadmap. That May 28th memo is a roadmap that tells her, here is how, going forward, you should improve your performance.
With this merger, was she supervising new people?
There were new people put into her group, yes.
And were there new people who were her supervisors?
Yes. In fact, Ms. Moser in Charlotte, North Carolina, her new supervisor was from the Nations Bank side of the merger, and Ms. Kramer came from the Bank of America side of the merger.
Well, two things strike me here. One is that this is fairly high finance. I'm from a smaller town, but if somebody makes $250,000 a year, it's a lot of money where I come from. So I assume this is not just some run-of-the-mill middle manager. Or am I wrong?
You're correct, Your Honor, that she definitely was someone who was in a position where she was expected to perform up to some very high standards and earn her keep, so to speak, and that she was given numerous opportunities to improve. But significantly, the issues that are raised with her, and in fact, the use of the term social ability, all come out before that June 18th letter from her attorney in which she discloses for the first time that she has multiple sclerosis and that she would like to assert her rights for an accommodation under the Americans with Disabilities
Act. Yeah, there's no dispute that no one at the bank knew about that.
Correct.
Before that letter.
Correct.
Now, what about the point that he made that there's conflicting testimony with respect to her job performance?
Therefore,
it wouldn't have been harmless error. How do you respond to that?
Essentially, Your Honor, there were really three categories of evidence that, even when the inferences are taken in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, or the testimony of disinterested witnesses that was uncontested, which is the Rule 50 standard. Looking at that evidence, Bank of America still wins. Plaintiff cannot meet her burden. And in particular, plaintiff's own admissions. We do set out those in our brief very clearly, but even plaintiff herself admits that the criticisms that Ms. Moser was making of her were that supervisor's opinions and honest opinions.
Well, of course, a jury could look at that and say that's the kind of person or attitude you need to run this kind of a place, and you got to, in order to generate those kinds of results, you got to be tough or something. The reason I mention that is a jury does sometimes think differently. The question, preliminarily, of course, is whether or not there's a right to a jury trial. And I think you should address that.
I certainly will, Your Honor. The district court was correct in his reading of the statute and in following those courts that interpreted the statute. And
before you get into specifics, can you just generally respond to this question? Wasn't the ADA drafted to mirror Title VII? Deal with that and then deal with the specifics.
Okay. At the time, the ADA was enacted. There was no right to compensatory or punitive damages under Title VII. And yes, there was debate at the time whether the ADA should allow a general right to damages or whether it should be restricted. And the legislative history that we've cited, the courts have cited, says the right to compensatory and punitive damages was taken out and the remedies were paralleling Title VII. Paralleling Title VII as it looked when the ADA was enacted in 1990. What changes is the Civil Rights Act of 1991 and that separate damages section, 1981A, the remedies under Title VII change. They no longer have that parallel track for the compensatory and punitive damages issue. They could very well have drafted 1981A to say, see above. Instead, they set out two separate sections, and the statute's actually at page 5 of our brief. There are two separate sections, the civil rights section, which is subsection 1 under right of recovery, and the disability, which is subsection 2. There was really no need to have the disability section at all if the remedies were going to continue to parallel. And I know that the appellant's counsel talked about there being some legislative history that even in the future, should the remedies change, that they will remain parallel. That legislative history comes from a committee report that considered the ADA. there certainly is nothing binding about a committee's speculation on what a future Congress might decide under some other analysis.
Well, the problem with legislative history, those of us who recall the debates for the 1991 Act, was it's very contentious. There were at least five separate drafts of creation of legislative history about the President, Congress, who thought what about what. So in that Act, there are lots of inconsistencies as far as who gets what. That's why it requires a careful reading of this statute. So I think that's the, at least in my own concern, is the analysis is it here or is it not? And that's what I guess the case you're trying to make.
That's correct. And I think that view is supported by the very carefully written opinion of Judge Gaetan in the Brown case out of the Western District of Missouri, where he really does trace what is there and what is not there. What plaintiffs would have us do in that subsection on disability is read only that general introductory clause and not read the phrases that come after that that modify the general introductory clause. There are specific statutes there, which means that the ones that aren't there should not be read into or implied.
Well, isn't retaliation an unlawful, intentional form of discrimination, and as such, shouldn't 12203 be impliedly covered by 1981A?
I don't think the implication is there, Your Honor, and that's because the statute goes on to say intentional acts of discrimination under, and then it talks about two sections of the Rehabilitation Act, and then the two sections of the Disability Act that are specifically mentioned. I think there's other support in 1981A also that there was not meant to be a general access to damages, that they were going to be limited. I think Section 3, for example, shows that Congress was thinking there was something different about the ADA, that the remedies weren't going to parallel Title VII, and that is they put in that good faith defense in situations where a plaintiff is claiming a failure to allow a reasonable accommodation. So, you know, again, an indication that there may have been some compromising going on in terms of how the ADA was going to be treated here versus simply mirroring the Title VII remedy. I think, too, a point needs to be made that it was not the 2005 remedies that were being amended, but 1991A is a separate section that allows for the compensatory and punitive damages, and in fact that language is found under subsection B. A complaining party may recover punitive damages under this section, not under 2005. So again, the trying to read back into a change in 2005, I think, is more of a contorted reading than there needs to be when the statute here is plain and understandable. I also want to talk about the issue of the I'm sorry.
Consent.
Right. Thank you. The jury trial by consent. The standard on this one is an abuse of discretion, and Judge Zagel did not abuse his discretion in this instance. First of all, Rule 38 does not apply here because once the compensatory and punitive damages statutory issue is taken care of, the jury trial as of right issue falls away and Rule 38 doesn't apply. And under Rule 39, consent can be withdrawn. In this case, it was withdrawn, and in this case, it was withdrawn in a timely manner. And Judge Zagel did not abuse his discretion in deciding that it was raised in a timely fashion. And I think looking at Rule 39C, first of all, the rule has two requirements. That's the consent of both parties. And then even if both parties consent, the judge may order a jury trial, not that he must do so. I think it's a very deferential standard. I think that Judge Daigle looked at the issues and properly weighed, you know, potential for prejudice in terms of making the decision at the time that it was made, and his decision was correct. In summary, I would ask that the court find that the district court correctly ruled that plaintiff had no statutory right to compensatory and punitive damages and therefore no statutory right to a jury trial, that the court correctly determined that she was not entitled to a jury trial by consent. And then also, in this situation, there is more than ample evidence in the record to show that no reasonable jury could have found in her favor, and that therefore, even had the jury issues been decided incorrectly, it was harmless error. Thank you.
Thanks. Mr. Hanfin.
On regards to the harmless error, again, Ms. Mixon was Ms. Moser's boss and had the final say on whether Ms. Kramer was going to be terminated from BOA. She had said that, as I read the quote before, that she was positively influencing others. That is at odds with the definition by Ms. Moser. Social ability was a pretext, and a reasonable jury, reasonable trier of fact, could have found other than Judge Daigle did. With regards to the statute again, as Judge Williams pointed out, the statute does say, 12.117, says that the powers, remedies set forth in sections 2000E5 shall apply. It doesn't limit it there. So I believe that under that statute and under 12.203, which refers to there, Ms. Kramer is a 12.203 plaintiff, stands in the shoes of a Title VII. And the legislative history did show that it's the parallel, and a number of cases have held that as well, that the remedies are to mirror and parallel. Finally, Ms. Moser did state that but for this lack of improvement in the alleged social ability, Ms. Kramer would not have been fired. That was the reason that was given for her termination, and again, the admission by Ms. Mixon refutes that, and a question of fact certainly existed, and the district court was making credibility determinations, which it is not allowed to do under the Rule 50 standard, and this should have been tried to a jury, and since it was jury trial was improperly denied, it should be remanded to the district court for a jury trial on all issues. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, and to both counsel, and the case will be taken under advisement.